How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
Welcome to Sustainable Futures. I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And I'm Kim Tay.
And today's show will be the second part of a two-part interview I had with Robert Cole, or Bob Cole. He is the gentleman who spent a year alone in the Patagonia wilderness, and he's talking about his adventures there.
Where is Patagonia?
It's an area off the west coast of Chile, and it's one of the windiest places in the world. That's part of the challenges he faced. But it's a small island that's not even on maps. Like very, very few maps will have that island. It'd have to be the smallest of the smallest map to even have it. Uninhabited, and he spent a year there. It's 200 miles off the coast of Chile.
Wow.
Which is the bottom of South America.
Very cool.
If people are interested in this interview, you can meet Bob Cole in Vancouver. He actually is a Vancouver resident, and he's going to be doing a talk at Vancouver Public Library from 7:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. this coming Tuesday, October 21st. And it will be a slideshow and storytelling, and he'll be doing book signings. So you can get more information on the adventure and sort of his perspectives, what he's taken from it by going to that event.
Awesome.
And I would like to mention that we're going to be picking up where the first part was more about his preparations and landing on the island and getting everything built. This is going to be more of the internal adventure. So he's talking a lot more about what it's like to actually be on an island and some of the things surrounding the whole adventure. So it gets really, really great. This is going to be a great, great interview for you.
So with no further ado, here is Ryan's interview with Bob Cole.
Do you get bored, or do you always find things to occupy yourself?
Sometimes I got bored, but not in the same way I get bored in the city. There's always stuff to occupy me. Mm-hmm. And a big part of the challenge for me was to not stay occupied. I intentionally went to not stay occupied because this was not just a survival adventure, but a spiritual journey.
Uh-huh.
That's what it was about. And so one of the things we do in our culture to avoid looking inward is we stay busy all the time.
Yeah.
And that carries over.
You can do that anywhere.
Absolutely. That tends to carry over into our wilderness experience. When you
uh-huh.
talk to people, there's very few people that go out into the wilderness to sit there. They
yeah.
go out to do something, and they're constantly active. They're challenging the wilderness somehow. And
mm-hmm.
I was specifically going for something else to try to explore a transformation of consciousness in which I would feel to be with the wilderness rather than against it or using it as a playground or anything like that. I was really trying to let go of that kind of egocentric
mm-hmm.
sense of things. So I made a real effort to leave lots of time without doing anything, and it's a challenge to do that, but there's always lots to do, and because it's so beautiful, it always takes time to do things, because everything I was doing, I'd stop and just be with the day,
mm-hmm.
and just sitting out in the wind and the rain is doing something in a way, you know. There's lots of coming in. There were definitely times when I didn't want to be there,
mm-hmm.
but I've been through enough in my life that I recognize that in those times I wouldn't want to be anywhere. And so there's no point in leaving or going someplace else, because when those feelings come up, it doesn't matter where I am. I just don't want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's working with that kind of
That's
stuff.
That's pretty deep. Yeah. Interesting.
Just allow myself to be with those experiences, because the real challenge in a wilderness, one of the real challenges, is that it's not so easy to escape from yourself.
Uh-huh.
We spend an enormous amount of time not actually exploring deeply who we are, and we all carry shadow material within, dark stuff about ourselves we don't want to face.
Mm-hmm.
And so we avoid that in any number of ways in our culture. And from my perspective, that's one of the big sources of environmental degradation, is that we're trying to avoid ourselves and trying to avoid certain kinds of feelings. And so we're constantly outdoing to the earth, and we have this feeling of emptiness and lack. And so we're constantly reaching out, trying to get it in a material way.
Mm.
And one of the side effects of that is to do an enormous amount of damage to the world around us, because we constantly want to grow to try to fill this sense of lack that we have. So I was exploring that and how to just be mm-hmm. with those feelings. And that's, you know, one of the real wonders of being in solitude, is having the opportunity just days and weeks and months to follow the inner rhythms and the rhythms of the non-human world, to live with the tides and the wind mm-hmm. and the changing seasons and the migrating birds, and just come into that kind of harmonious mm. spaciousness. And it wasn't always that way. It was one of the fascinating things is the inner changes that take place. I discovered that for me, the cleanest, simplest way to look at it was that I have inner weather as well as outer weather. And in the same way that there's outer storms, there's inner storms as well. And, mm-hmm. and I'm not in control of those. That's part of weather, and it's how I relate to those changes that mm-hmm. that's important. But I'd be sitting there and just feeling really joyful and woven into the universe, and then I could just watch this inner shift take place, in which I would start to feel cut off and anxious and alienated. And I go, what happened? Nothing's just happened. Usually when that happens to us, we think that some external
You're tied to something. Yeah.
But, you know, I would just go, nothing's changed around me. And so what just happened here? Or I'd be all tangled up and stuff and beating up on myself and self-critical and the world sucked. And then all of a sudden there'd just be a sense of release and slipping free from all of that. And this feeling of just being, wow, okay, everything is just fine the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that process remains mysterious. One of the things I went for is to learn to control that process, and I never did. And so mm-hmm. for me it was developing a willingness to be with whatever's going on and surrender to it.
Yeah.
And just be with that that mysterious flow of the universe. We have this notion that we own ourselves. You know, we believe we own the earth as human beings, and that as individuals we own ourselves.
Uh-huh.
And it's a strange illusion.
Yeah.
It's a very strange illusion.
And it goes deep, I bet.
Oh, yeah.
It goes deep. A lot of people probably say, well, no, I know I don't know. You know, I don't own that. But then if you look deeper, I think a lot of people still do. That kind of
I mean, all of this stuff is easy enough to talk about. It's the actual internalizing, moving the experience from intellectual knowing to actual knowing, living knowing. And that's an ongoing process. I'm not in any way saying that I accomplished it all. There are times and moments, but it's, for me, an ongoing process. So mm-hmm. I don't make any claims to final enlightenment or perfectionism or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all this being said, is this something you would recommend for people to do?
Well, I don't recommend deep wilderness solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I specifically don't recommend it because my sense is it's difficult and it can be dangerous and painful. And it requires quite a lot of skills on both the physical and the psycho-spiritual level. And mm-hmm. so I think in order to be ready to do it, you really need to feel an inner call to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got that call, then you don't need anybody else's recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
You'll know that I need to do this. But I do think that we, you know, can all benefit from spending some time with ourselves, from slowing down. We spend a huge amount of time denying that the world is the way it is and that we are the way we are. It's just huge. So it's amazing how much time and effort we spend denying reality, and all of us, in various, very subtle ways. Our whole notion of progress is that, in some ways, we'll make things better tomorrow, and it's a way of denying how things are today. So I think that that's useful kind of for anybody to spend some time with themselves, some quiet time. Part of that process is letting go of our desires to some extent, learning to do with less, so we're not on such a frantic rat race of constantly out there reaching for more, but allowing ourselves to appreciate what we've got. Because we spend a huge amount of time reaching for, trying to fulfill our desires, and equally trying to get away from our lives as they actually are. I don't want this, but I do want that, I do want that. And if we can relax that a little bit, we never get rid of it completely. But if we can relax those desires and aversions a little bit, it generates more spaciousness and a sense of freedom and stillness in our lives that, for me, is kind of the source of inner peace, and that feels really useful to me. So daily meditation, I think, is huge.
Is that something you took up?
I discovered meditation when I came out of my first long wilderness retreat in my 20s for 2 months, and I got really confused after, because I almost didn't make it back from the retreat. I almost went insane. But after there were some transformations of consciousness out there that I just went, wow, this is amazing. I really did feel woven into the universe, and I thought someday I'd like to spend a year. I figured I'd just live in that state of sort of blissed out light and a sense of, one of the things that's for me the most profound joy is, and it's not all the time by any means, and this is one of the reasons I get so tangled up in solitude, is when I don't feel this and I'm trying to make it happen, which is worse. And it's a feeling that the whole world is vibrantly alive, that we kind of go through our days feeling like we're alive. But then when we actually have those moments where we, you know, everything just comes alive, and it's, you know, we think usually trees are alive, animals are alive, rocks are dead. But there's a transformation that takes place in which it's all alive. The sky is alive. The sea is alive. There aren't these separate things, some of which we call alive and some not, you know, organic and inorganic. It's everything's alive. And the rock is present. It's pulsatingly present. And it can be a terrifying experience to be that vulnerable in this vibrantly alive universe. But it's just profoundly joyful. And I thought I would live in that state when I came out of my first time of solitude. I lost it over the next year, and everything became really dark and depressed. There was a sense of losing contact with spirit.
Is this after coming back?
Not this time. This is when I was in my 20s. And so the next year was, I thought I'd done something seriously wrong spiritually, that I was a coward. I hadn't had the inner strength to continue to live with this experience. And and eventually I discovered Buddhist meditation, and the teachers, you know, I would talk to some teachers, and they said, no, this is just part of the journey. There are these ups and downs. And if you were on a long retreat, especially in solitude, there are experiences developed that are very, very difficult to maintain in the busy world. And that's just learning to allow all those movements to happen as part of the journey. And so since then, I've meditated on and off, sometimes more regularly than others. I'm meditating regularly now. I stopped for several years when I was teaching scuba diving in the Caribbean, because diving, in a way, is meditation. And so just being under the water, that was my meditation. And often when I've been in the university, very focused on the academic world, I lose track of my heart. It's all mind stuff.
Right. You spend your days up in the mind. And,
so that was another part of this. Is a big part is I started at McGill as an undergraduate when I was 40 after the motorcycle crash. I was teaching scuba diving in the Caribbean, and one day I was off to go diving with the whales, the humpback whales, and a drunken farmer came out of a sugarcane field, blind, you know, on the highway, and just smashed into me, and I ended up getting flown to Montreal to the Royal Victoria Hospital and spent most of a year there trying to save my foot, and eventually it couldn't save it. The infection was too bad, and so ended up with a prosthetic leg, and at first, I lost my scuba business and everything, and at first I could barely walk. It was real painful. And so I thought, well, you know, I can't just sit here and do nothing, so maybe I'll try university. I'd started at Berkeley when I was 19 and flunked out, got in the way of my street life, and I just wasn't interested. But you know, I'd always had an intellectual hunger, so I started at McGill and couldn't decide whether to do biology or psychology because teaching diving is kind of on the cusp. You deal with people's fears and teaching them and getting them to go into the ocean, and then once you're there, you switch over to marine biology to show them the underwater world. And so I couldn't decide, and I just went back and forth, and I finally ended up doing both.
Yeah.
And then a minor in environmental studies. So it took 5.5 years, and it was really, you know, I had such a my own history of living to come into this domain and be told my own lived experience wasn't meaningful, that just learning facts and theories.
Yeah, I had troubles with that, too.
You know, it was a slow process, but by the end of 5.5 years, I thought something's seriously amiss here. What's going on?
There's a problem with the system.
A fellowship to go on for grad school in biology, and I thought, well, I better, you know, I want to go and see what's going on here. And so I went into solitude in northern Quebec for a couple of months, and the world came alive again, and so did I. And I went, oh, I was just caught up in the intellectual world of theory and fact, and it had very little to do with, you know, my own experience in walking through the world.
Yeah.
So when I started at UBC, that was one of the my real fundamental requirements in doing this, that I was going to bring in myself into the process. I wasn't going to leave myself out of it anymore and just do some kind of abstract study. And I was very careful in getting a PhD committee together of people that were willing to go on an adventure. And my original notion, because I had this fellowship in biology, was to do an animal behavior study. But I was going to go live in the wilderness and include myself as the researcher in the process. Because one of the things that I found really interesting when I was doing biology at McGill was the notion of neo-Darwinian evolution is based largely on competition between distinct organisms. And yet, when I'm out in the wilderness, my consciousness changes. I experience the world as a flowing whole. And each of us, as organisms, are a manifestation of this underlying unity. And so it's like, oh, well, what does this mean? If we're not really separate individuals on the most profound level, what does that mean for evolution? And there certainly, it seems to be consciousness present in the universe. It didn't just pop into existence with higher organisms. And so if that's the case, what does that mean? If there's consciousness inherent in the universe, then maybe evolution isn't just random chance. Maybe there's something else going on here.
There's an evolution of consciousness.
Well, there's I think evolution of consciousness, but what role does consciousness play in physical evolution, sort of a thing, right? You know, maybe it's not
That's
just random genetic mutations that natural selection works on. Maybe there's something else, some more unifying principles going on. And I wasn't taught any of that stuff in biology at McGill, and it's generally amongst, you know, normal scientists just poo-pooed. And if you question neo-Darwinian evolution, you're immediately accused of being a creationist, sort of a thing. You know, as though there's no fertile ground between those two extremes of hard-edged neo-Darwinianism and creationism. But there's an enormous amount of fertile ground in there for exploration.
Well, I could see that. I mean, Darwin is held up like a god that cannot
be
denied.
Yeah, the fanatics on the neo-Darwinian side are just as fanatical as Christian fundamentalists. You know, it's belief in. And so many biological studies, it's not even questioned. You know, the theory is accepted as truth, and then it's just applied to different circumstances. So anyway, I wanted to question all of these things. And the other thing I wanted to do was, given the fact that the world seems different when there's a transformation of consciousness, then maybe there isn't just one science. Maybe science, the kind of science we do, depends on our level of consciousness. And so this starts bringing in the social science side of things. In the natural sciences, mostly it's assumed, even on a working level, not necessarily the philosophy of science, but on the working level, that there's an objective universe that everybody is studying, the same universe. Social scientists are very clear that that's not the case. You know, anthropologists and sociologists, that what the study is depends on who the researcher is. You know, what they look at, how they frame the questions, what they consider important. So the researcher is considered an integral, not all schools of social science, but, you know, the qualitative side, is the researcher is an integral part of the process, and they don't presume or pretend to some kind of God's eye objectivity. They're very clear. No, this is what I saw, and you take responsibility for your point of view. So I thought, well, this, you know, I'll bring this into the natural sciences and try to build a hybrid between the social and the natural sciences. And I was at UBC for, 3.5 years doing background reading and trying to figure out what I was going to do. And two things happened during that time. One is that I figured that I really probably couldn't pull this off, trying to do an animal behavior study, a natural history study of PhD quality work, and try to include all the psycho-spiritual stuff into the process, that it was it was beyond me. And the second thing is I came to admit to myself that the animal that really interested me, the behavior that really interested me, was myself, the human being, and the effects of deep wilderness solitude on the physical and emotional, psychological and spiritual aspects of a human being. And so I just decided that I would be my own subject. And, you know, clearly there are some professors that looked askance at this idea that I was going to be both the subject and the researcher. You know, it's too circular, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and no objectivity. And but you know, one of the joys of the educational system is there are niches that you can move into if you get a committee that is willing to support your work. And so I just had a brilliant committee.
Yes.
So one of my recommendations would be for anybody doing graduate work is to often that step of choosing a supervisor and choosing a committee can almost be automatic, and you're, it's kind of foisted on you as the student. And I think that's the most important step of the whole process. If you get people you can work with that are open-minded, that are willing to go on an adventure with you, that don't think they have all the answers, it can be wonderful. On the other hand, if they're trying to jam you into their mold, their view of the world, it can be a horribly frustrating process.
Yes, and I understand there's a whole lot of politics around that, too.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm not one myself, but I know a lot of people who are, and there's always loads of politics around
that. No, it can definitely be that. And I think, too, is another thing that is if somebody wants to do really oddball work, experimental work, it's probably best to get somebody that's already got tenure as committee members that aren't so at risk. Because, when, you know, when you're in the process of getting your own tenure as a young prof, you've got a double whammy going if you take on a student that's doing some radical stuff, because if they fail, then, you know, it shines badly on you. But if you've got somebody that's established their own reputation, that they don't have so much at stake in it. But I just had a brilliant committee. I had people from all over UBC. I had somebody from forestry and somebody from biology and a poet from language and literacy and somebody from commerce and another person from education, and it was a joy. We'd all, and one of the joys was introducing them to each other. They didn't know each, some of them knew each other beforehand, but not all. And so meeting each other and the committee meetings, sometimes I'd just disappear into the woodwork. You know, they just have such a good time talking with each other that, you know, I was kind of the context for it, but the air would turn blue with ideas and excitement, you know, because they all had very, very different perspectives of coming at the world from their different disciplines. And so it was, and they often didn't get to share with people from other parts of the university. We all get so insular in our own little stream. So that was a real exciting part of the process. And I had some very good writers on my committee, some brilliant editors, and that also was hugely valuable to me. I learned how to write. And after that, I've worked with some other just superb editors at the publishing house. And so the whole process has been wonderful in learning how to write, because it's a challenge learning to write well. And transforming the dissertation into this book was a whole nother story. You know, I started doing it, and I thought one of the things I've learned is that editing is, you got to edit and edit and edit and edit and edit. There's a few writers, I suppose, like Mozart, you know, could just write music, and a few people can just write, but not very many of us. Most of us is just, you know, getting it down there and then grinding it out and polishing it and shaping it and deleting and reinserting it over and over and over until things start to seem clean and and mostly in academics, we don't do that, because very little academics is written for the pleasure of the reader.
For the reader, yeah.
You know, it's
usually dry as toast.
And it's justified, oh, I'm just sharing information. And I think that's a huge mistake.
Yeah.
There's no reason at all why academic writing can't be thrilling and wonderful, but it just takes a lot of time and effort, and it's not rewarded usually. You know?
Well, it wouldn't be rewarding to write either, I wouldn't find. I mean, myself, anyway.
Academic writing, you mean? I don't like it, and I can't stand to read it.
Yeah.
I remember, and most academic talks are kind of like that way, too. I remember going to a talk in the Faculty of Forestry while I was there, and it seemed like it was going to be exciting. A grad student introduced this speaker, and the grad student was all excited about how wonderful this guy was, a young speaker, and he was a jazz musician, apart from, you know, his academic work. He was an ecologist of some sort, I believe, and she was saying, yeah, you know, he was a wonderful musician, and this guy gets up there, and he's just alive, you know. He's saying, oh, God, I love jazz. I love the spontaneity of it, of just riffing off of each other. And I'm sitting up in my chair going, wow, this is going to be a cool talk. And then it's like a switch. He flipped a switch inside himself. And he said, but we're not here to talk about jazz today. And he died right in front of my eyes.
Yeah.
Went into his PowerPoint presentation with graphs and charts and all that. And there's nothing wrong with graphs and charts. That's an important part of science. But, my God, he just died. All the emotional excitement went out of him. And it was like he started using jargon. And I went, what did you do that for? Why did you just disconnect from yourself as a human being and from us as human beings in the audience? What value is there? You can give so much more information and have your listeners much more alive to receive it if you're fully communicating as a human being, including emotion and physicality and wonder and joy, all those things. It doesn't have to be dry facts or only dry facts. The dry facts can be there, but you can have lots more, too. So I don't know why academics insists on that, and it's changing happily. You know, people are writing in the first person now, and which is a huge, but that can be window dressing unless the fundamentals change underneath that. But.
You are listening to Sustainable Futures. This is an interview with Bob Cole.
Okay, I'd like to go back on this island for a little bit.
Sure.
I asked this question before. I'd like to do it because I have another radio program called Melodies in Mind.
Okay.
And while you're out on the island, did you ever get a song stuck in your head?
Yep. With frequency.
Yes.
And they just keep going through my head and going through my head. And there was, the Bob Marley tune. Was it Three Little Birds? I think it's called, you know, Every Little Thing's Gonna Be All Right.
Oh, yes, that one.
This morning, that one would go around and around and around.
I have that one, too.
Mm-hmm. And another one is I Am a Rock, I Am an Island.
Oh, yeah, because you're on an island, so every time...
And Garfunkel, and of course... I
could imagine how that
an island, but that would go around and around.
Yeah.
What were some of the others? Oh, one of the real tedious ones was a good-hearted woman. It's a country western song. Good-hearted woman in love with a good-timing man.
Uh-huh.
And that's the only words I could remember, and I wasn't even sure those were right. And around and around.
Yeah.
It was pretty funny. Oh, the other one that I really did like was the Navajo beauty song. Now I walk in beauty. Beauty is before me. Beauty is behind me.
Yeah.
Beauty is above me. Beauty is all around me. Mm-hmm. A really lovely song. So,
yeah,
that happens.
Yeah, I make a little study of it myself because...
Oh, that's neat.
I mean, informal, but it's always connected to where you are, so you'll get something. I can just imagine how that I'm a Rock one, you'll be thinking.
Yeah.
Island thought comes into your mind. I'm on an island.
Yeah.
And then you're in a good mood or something, and you're like, I'm a Rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's... The Bob Marley one, when things were going to crap, and I thought, oh, man, this really sucks, and it was like, every little thing's going to be all right.
Yeah.
And dreams are that way, too, right? You know, for quite a while, it was this notion that dreams are somehow all symbolic and nothing else, and there's some of that, but most dreams that I have are... clearly related to what's going on in the day, you know, what's been happening, and they're just rehashing of that and different perspectives and stuff on that like that, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so, I talk to myself, of course.
Yeah.
And I'd have conversations. You know, I'd catch myself talking to myself, and I'd say, Bob, you're talking to yourself again. Go, yeah, I know, but there's nobody else here. It's okay. that would be a two-part conversation.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, a lot of listeners would probably be thinking of the movie Castaway and the soccer ball.
I didn't see Castaway till I came back.
Yeah.
I hadn't read Robinson Crusoe till I came back either.
Yeah.
What was very interesting was I thought Robinson Crusoe was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And I did some research, and as far as I can tell, the author never spent time in solitude. But he got, in my view, a real sense of the transformations that happened. I think he really understood it somehow. It was amazing. When I saw Castaway, I was deeply disappointed in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought, these people don't know what solitude's about. They don't get it. They have an illusion, an imagination of it, what they think it would be like.
Mm-hmm.
And most fundamentally, it's the absence of people. And they seem to be coming from the current sort of mindset of many people that the only meaningful way of relationship is with other human beings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the only meaning in our lives, social interactions with other human beings. And so since he was the only human being and the only way, the only possibility for communication was with another human being, he had to create a surrogate with the volleyball. What they never seemed to get was that he was embedded in a living world.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's the potential to be in relationship.
Yeah, I don't remember them ever touching on that, really.
Didn't touch it at all. He always remained man against, never man with. And I thought that that was a huge loss for the viewer. Now, they did move him through the transformation of letting go of time. You know, that was their big letting go. For Robinson Crusoe, he let go of some of his Christian judgments about how the world is and really saw through that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Tom Hanks movie, he saw through the illusion of time in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But they never got that he was actually in relationship with spirit, with the presence of in the non-human world. What was remarkable is we in the audience did experience that through the cinematography. We were brought into relationship with the non-human world. But he, as the actor and the hero, never went there.
Mm-hmm.
Very strange.
Okay. Now, what's it like to return to society after you spend a year in the wilderness?
It's a challenge. Always been a challenge. We touched on earlier coming back from my first 3 months retreat, and it was really hard. It was just dark and depressed. I was convinced I had done something profoundly wrong in my life.
And where did that come from? Like, I don't quite understand where that came from.
Well, in solitude, when we go through the world in society, we have a set of filters in place. Because it's chaotic and we're trying to accomplish things that we're focused on. And we also always have survival filters in place. So we're only experiencing a small slice of everything that's impinging on us, inwardly and outwardly. And you know, so our attention is just a very small subset of what's actually going on.
Oh, yes, yes.
In solitude, particularly if your intention is to slow down, those filters start to soften and dissolve. And the world becomes much larger, more spacious, and filled with light and wonder. And because you're more and more present, I'm more and more present because that's what I go for, to come into the here and now over and over. When I catch my mind drifting off to the past or the future, I bring it back to the here and now. Not having to fulfill social demands and just allowing myself to be whatever I am and experience whatever comes up. And it's a painful process, as I've said. You got to face some darkness, but there's wonder. You know, it's like, wow, the world is so much richer than I had imagined.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought I was alive, but I haven't been alive. I've been kind of a robot going through an automatic pilot, and there's a sense of vibrancy, and also there's a feeling of discovering yourself on a really profound level of coming into relationship with your own deeper self. And in part of that is to find out that there's spirit, there's something non-material in the world that we're part of. In the same way we're part of the larger ecological physical world, we're also part of a larger non-physical world that our consciousness belongs to. And that's an incredibly joyful experience, to feel that sense of participation and one with that flowingness that of the non-material. Mm-hmm. When I came back, I lost that. Mm-hmm. And there was an enormous sense of grief. It was like being profoundly in love with someone and losing that person.
Yeah.
And
have a
sense of desolation of what's wrong, what happened here, and cut off and alienation and isolation.
Yeah.
And another way, I think that the metaphor of a relationship, either somebody dies or the relationship breaks up. And maybe a relationship breaking up is, if you haven't chosen it, you know, if you're kind of the one left behind, is in some ways the more powerful, because there's this feeling that I know this is still here. I know this possibility is still here. Now I've lost it, and what have I done, and why, how can I get it back, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And another analogy is traveling into a foreign culture. If you've traveled to a foreign culture, and again, there's that sense of aliveness, of day-by-day vibrancy. You're just really fully present. And if you travel for a long period of time, months, there's a sense that you've changed. I've really changed. And there's this imagination, when I go back home, wherever that happens to be, I'll be a different person.
Yeah, no, I went through that.
Right, and you get back and you find out that old habit patterns are pretty strong.
Yeah.
Right, and old relationships, you start doing the kinds of things you used to do, and the world feels kind of dull again, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's a really painful. So the culture shock, the reverse culture shock of coming back in some ways is mm-hmm. really painful. Then we got to just start chipping away at it again, using what we remember as inspiration, and trying to, when we catch ourselves feeling deadened and not really paying attention to our lives in the here and now, come back and to recognize that wherever we are is just as vibrantly alive as any place else. You know, mm-hmm. other people come to visit us in Vancouver and they go, wow, 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 sort of a thing. And so, you know, to recognize, no, it's all right here. And if spirit exists in the wilderness, it's got to be in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And if the wilderness is sacred, so do the city. It's all part of the same world.
Universe. Reginald Ray says that. Are you familiar with Reginald Ray?
Some. No, I haven't read a lot. Yeah.
I actually managed, I was fortunate enough to see him speak. And he was in Vancouver. And mm-hmm. he said that he's gotten to a point where he can see that. And it's something that he's been experiencing lately. He's just, in the city, he can still pick up the natural world around him.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
One of my favorite, I think it was Abby Hoffman, but I'm not sure. Absolute favorite aphorisms is, the closest wilderness area is within you. And I think that is a really profound teaching, that we're caught up largely on the social level of who we are, our social definitions of ourselves. And yet that wildness is within us. We are ancient members of the universe and biological beings. And our culture is also a manifestation of that wildness, but we can directly experience, and that's what meditation is good for, to just pay attention, our own beingness, our own breathing and physicality, and moving beyond the kind of conceptual definitions of who we are. Because
mm-hmm.
one of the terrors and challenges is when, in solitude, is one of the things we do for each other in culture is we mirror each other. And that can be a hugely valuable process if you're with somebody that will actually mirror you honestly and clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty rare. Mostly we have social conventions, and we mirror for each other what we want to see of ourselves. So I have a social persona that I project onto the world, and partly what we do is help each other hold our social persona in place so that we don't have to experience the dark sides of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And in solitude, that starts to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an idea of who we are, and we are deeply identified with that idea. And when that starts to fall apart, it can feel like physical death. Real.
Mm-hmm.
It can be terrifying, or insanity. The other thing that comes up is insanity. And so it's like getting the carpet pulled out from under you when that starts to fall apart. And if you can be with it and relax into it, to kind of surrender, there's a discovery that, oh, the carpet wasn't in thin air. I'm not falling into a void. I'm something, I actually exist as something much more profound than this superficial idea I had of myself. I'm this much richer and infinite process of interactions and relationships and all of this. And to explore that is one of the joys as well. And it's not just solitude, clearly. That's one of the things I do. It's not the only thing, but yeah. But, it, you know, relationships, if we have honest relationships that we can invite each other into deeper kinds of explorations of who we are together and with each other and alone, that is hugely. But it's scary. There's always a sense of vulnerability involved.
Yeah. Another thing I've been curious about, because I also read another account of someone who spent a lot of time in solitude, and when they came back in this book, they talked about the noise.
Uh-huh.
And they don't realize how much noise there is on the on just a regular ongoing basis.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
One of the huge relaxations is to be away from internal combustion engines. The only noise I experienced, I heard airplanes twice during the year, and other than that, the only noise I experienced was my own noise, outboard motor and chainsaw, and it's very different when you're making the noise yourself. It's quite interesting how different noise is when you're the one creating it.
Yeah, I guess you can predict it, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah, I think there's that. But I was just up coast in BC for 7 weeks, and there wasn't a day that I didn't hear multiple engines. It's just,
yeah.
It's just everywhere in our culture, and sometimes I think it'll be a real blessing when we run out of oil.
Yeah.
We're just so inundated with machine noise. And
a lot of people share that. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things I try to do is, well, there's a couple things that are interesting is, when I'm out in the wilderness and a plane flies over a helicopter, I wonder, well, what are the animals? You know, what, is this as disrupting to them? But one of the things that was fascinating is when I was out in my outboard, dolphins had come around and they'd play with the boat, you know, and that's always a wonderful thing is the dolphins are playing. But as soon as I shut off the outboard, they'd go away. Or if I was out in my kayak paddling, I'd think, okay, you know, dolphins, come on, let's play. They'd be out there in the basin out in front of my cabin and I'd go out and they'd take off. And I went, well, this sucks.
Yeah.
They don't like me. They like my outboard. You know, and it was really fascinating to recognize that they really liked that vibration.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of wondering, well, maybe other animals also like the sound of engine noise. I don't know. I'm not saying they do. I'm just know that dolphins sure liked it. You know, they came around to the vibrations. And one of the things I try to do in the city is treat engine noise and the sound of buses and trucks driving by, all of those kinds of noises, to try to relate to it as energy and go, okay, if I heard this roar and it was a waterfall, it would be, wow.
Yeah.
Why now, because it's a mechanical noise, do I find it appalling and you know, intrusive? What's the difference? And to try to let go of my judgments about it, my definitions, and just experience it as auditory energy. And one of the, it's the same thing, you know, with trying to experience buildings as vibrantly alive in the same way as forests are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge challenge. I have moments, and then it's gone again.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's quite interesting, I think, is the differences is, with a motor, what we look for and what we find pleasing in a motor, especially if it's our own car or something, is regularity. We want it to sound the same from moment to moment to moment. And if it starts to change and develops alternate sounds in there, it's cause for signals to go off, alarms to go off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's that knocking? What's that squeaking? What's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
So we want regularity, repeatable regularity. And that is just the opposite of what we value in the non-mechanistic world.
Mm-hmm.
What we value is the constant change. Everything is constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a big difference between what humans create, and that carries over to our buildings. We want our buildings to kind of stay the same, because if they don't, then we have to repair them or paint them or whatever. And I love falling down buildings. I love old buildings that are falling apart, because they show the change and of the moving universe. So I think that that's one of the differences between cities and non-human landscapes. Coming back this time was a challenge. Patty came down, my friend came down to spend a month on the island with me after I'd been there a year to kind of help me through the transition. And it's funny because...
Well, that's an interesting idea. Did that help?
Her idea. She said that she thought I was going to need some kind of transition, and she was right. It was really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
When she arrived, she told me later that she was planning. She thought, oh, you know, we won't really talk for the first week. I have to be really careful not to overwhelm this poor guy. He's been out here for a year by himself. And I never shut up. Never shut up. Constantly telling her stories about him. And again, it was really important that who she was. She wasn't just anybody. We have a relationship of openness. So one of the really painful things, if you've spent time in solitude and then you get into relationship with people you can't speak your mind to, you can't, you know, you're having to guard yourself and be careful about what you say, that starts setting up all kinds of inner tensions. And so I didn't have to do that with her. You know, I could just, whatever came up, I could share that openly with her. And then after she left and went back to Texas, I stayed down in the small Puerto Natales for a couple of more months, just kind of being there and soaking up the small town before I headed up to Santiago de Chile. And
Could be another transition step, I guess, a small
town.
It was, and
getting back in the city, I felt very threatened by the masses of people, worried I was going to get ripped off. And then I realized, no, you know, this is no different than being out on my small boat in the ocean. I have to watch out for the wind and the waves, and it's just being alert to what's going on. And I thought that I was handling the transition back pretty well. I got back to Vancouver and found a place to live and started sitting in front of my computer not writing my dissertation. I came back with 900 pages of journal, and I thought, how am I ever going to turn this into a doctoral dissertation?
Yeah.
I didn't have a clue. I just sat in front of my computer not having any idea where to start sifting through this. And I spent most of a year not doing anything. And then, you know, the media discovered it, and so there was a lot of interviews and television and radio stuff and newspaper stuff for a while, and then that passed. And I would journal once in a while, but mostly journaling for me is a solitary thing. When I'm around people, I don't journal every day. It's just it comes up in solitude. And mostly the journal was about not getting anything done on the dissertation.
Yeah.
And then eventually I started working through the journal, and in one entry, there was an entry saying, you know, when I get out of here, maybe it would be good for me to work with a therapist for a while. You know, I'm doing a lot of introspective and inner work, but possibly I've got blind spots that I simply can't see, that some mirroring with somebody would be very useful. So I started seeing a therapist in Vancouver, and I worked with her for 3 years. During that time, as I was editing not only the journal from the wilderness, but also my journal on reentry, I realized that I had been really depressed again this time. It was just a softer kind of depression. It wasn't such a hammer blow, but it seems so far to be, as much as I'm aware and to let go of trying to hold on to what was in the wilderness and just be with what is here, it seems to be part of the process for me to kind of go through a sense of loss and grieving when I come back.
Well, we covered quite a lot.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about and now that we're outward?
Couple of other things, maybe. One of the things that was interesting is the national parks down there, when they did come to visit that one time, they really liked the shelter I'd built and said that, you know, why don't I leave it up as a refuge for other people? And that was really tempting, because it would have been way easier to just walk away, take my stuff and walk away, than deconstruct the whole thing.
Yeah.
Emotionally, especially, because I'd spent such a huge amount of time and effort building it to tear it back
staple by staple.
Yeah, exactly. But I knew that the wind and the sun would rot the tarp, and it would scatter it around. It would turn into a mess. And I didn't want that. And the other thing, even more importantly, is one of the things we do as human beings is we're constantly spreading the human hegemony. And so we go into a wilderness area, and the first thing we want to do is name everything. And then we want to build trails, and we want to build campgrounds, and eventually hook it up with roads and all that stuff. And I thought, no, I don't want to do that here. And so I didn't name this little island I was on. People asked me, what did you name it? I said, it got its own name. It's not a human name. And I really wanted to give this back to the world of itself, to the animals and the trees that live there, and to the sky and the sea. And so we tore everything down. We're scrupulous about picking up all the nails and everything. And I had 10 big bags of garbage when we left, of partly tarp. And also, every time I saw plastic that had floated in from the sea lanes, I'd stop on whatever beach and pick it up, collect it. So I had a lot of bags of trash that I found in the area, because it just felt like part of my gift to the place.
To the island, yeah.
So there's a real sense of, you know, there's talk of zero impact camping, which is, an oxymoron. You don't do anything with zero impact. Just like the idea of sustainable development, if you're talking about material development, is an oxymoron. You can't develop endlessly.
Yes.
But you can have, I think, a sustainable impact in which the Earth can heal itself.
I have big issues with that one.
Yeah.
Sustainable development. That's
an impossibility. And so what I was doing was definitely not sustainable if there had been 100 or 200 or 300 other people in the area. But because I was the only one and there wouldn't be anybody else there for a while, it would heal. Mm-hmm. So I was cutting firewood and I was fishing and stuff like that. But it would have an opportunity to heal. And so I just tried to lighten my footprint as much as I possibly could so that it would heal as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, that was an important part of the process for me, is to try to leave it as much as possible like it had been.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I think is important is going into wilderness solitude is not necessary or even, necessarily a good thing for everybody. It's just one of the things I do. It's not my whole life. It's part of my practice. And that our real challenge is to come into our lives as they are, however we're living. There tends to be kind of a heroic mythology around adventure, wilderness adventure. And the movie Into the Wild was portrayed as this heroic kind of mythological adventure. And I don't see myself as a hero. This is just what I was doing. And anybody that goes to work every day and raises children and does environmental work or whatever, if they do it fully, if we really live our lives fully, it's a heroic adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And, if we go through the motions, then it doesn't matter where we're doing that. And so I think the real challenge is not to sit and dream about escaping to a remote island, but to fully engage with our lives as they are and to embrace the difficult parts, because that's where real growth can take place.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the places we want to avoid. And I'm not saying I do that all the time. I work with it, and I still escape in my mind, et cetera, et cetera. But, we all have endless opportunities to come into the presence of our lives and accept ourselves and things as they are right here and now. And I think that that's our challenge.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. This was a delightful conversation. I appreciate you calling.
So I've been speaking with Bob Cole, who is author of the book just recently released, Solitude, Seeking Wisdom in Extreme, A Year Alone in the Patagonia Wilderness.
One more thing is my website.
Yeah.
People can find photographs on my website. It's Bob Cull, BobKull.org.
Okay. Do you have speaking engagements coming up?
Oh, I do, yes. Thank you. The next two major speaking engagement book launches will be here in Vancouver, one at the downtown Vancouver Library, sponsored by Banyan Books, and it's on October 21st, starting at 7:30 p.m., and the other one is at UBC in the First Nations House of Learning on October 16th, and that starts at 7 p.m., and that's a potluck afterwards, so anybody that'd like to go to that one needs to bring something to share with others to eat.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks again.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
So there you have it. That's Bob Cole.
Very interesting.
And I actually started reading his book just a while ago, and I'm about 50 pages in. It's like a diary style book where it goes day by day in what's happened that day while he's all alone out there on that island. And I'm finding it to be very entertaining. It's as much entertaining as it is informative. It's interesting to see from day to day how his mood swings go through. He certainly did not do a personal edit of it to take out all of his better moments. They're all in there, And I really appreciate that and find that that makes the book seven times more interesting than it would have been otherwise. It's a completely unique book. If you read any other books that are of the sort of spiritual adventure, someone on an island kind of thing. This is completely unique. It is very, very accessible. As you've gotten from the interview, he has a really approachable human side that just goes to show that he's just like everybody else, and he's not some kind of hero that is above us all. He's just another, you know, everyday person that decided to do something that's a bit unusual. Mm-hmm. And you get that sense from his book, so it's really great.
Well, what I think he attempted to prove or show, it's very valiant, because I don't think that I could ever live by myself. I'm an only child. I like time by myself, but let me tell you, I need to be around people.
Yes.
I don't know if I could do that, but I do think that what he was trying to show in terms of having a sustainable impact on the area.
As he said in the first half of the interview, he's a word person, and he's very conscious of the language he uses. And once again, he's going to be at the Vancouver Public Library from 7:30 to 9 p.m. this coming Tuesday if you want to meet Bob Cole. Thank you very much. I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And I'm Kim Tay.
And we are wishing you
a sustainable future.